Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start today by taking a look at what lies amidst the rubble and weeds where factories and businesses once stood. Our guest says a great deal of natural beauty resides there, and our guest, Christopher Brown, is an Austin, Texas-based writer, lawyer, and author. He's written three novels, but his first nonfiction book is titled The Natural History of Empty Lots, Field Notes from Urban Edgelands, Back Alleys, and Other Wild Places. The book is based on an urban nature newsletter titled Field Notes, which Chris Brown has authored since 2020. And as we talk with Christopher, I hope you'll join in. Call in with your questions about the rewilding of land used and discarded by industry. You have some in your area that maybe you notice, or maybe you kind of pass by and never pay any attention to. I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about those spots. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christopher Brown, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Larry. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed your book. It's a work of nonfiction, nature writing, really, and a memoir, I think. Before this, you wrote three novels, science fiction and some legal thrillers. Why did you want to write this very different book?
You know, well, while I was writing novels, I had spent about 20 years exploring, initially as a young dad looking for things to do with my son, and then solo, exploring these wild spaces that exist in the city, in the kind of interstices and the edges of the cities, something I really even did as a kid growing up in the Midwest, and reinvigorated after I got down here to Texas. And I found that it was, you know, really a fascinating and kind of underexplored aspect of how we live and how close we really do live to natural wonder, even in the heart of the city. And so when I finished my last novel, I started this kind of weekly newsletter that conveniently turned out to be 2 weeks before the pandemic started, when people were especially interested in this kind of material, just kind of writing like a little dispatch, you know, like Aldo Leopold style, from, you know, a little walk in the woods behind the dairy plant, or, you know, crossing the urban river or down under the overpass and reporting on the things I saw and found. And I learned that people were super interested in that. And so I wanted to write a book that kind of shared the things I learned in those explorations and in rewilding our own backyard, basically taking kind of Midwest style prairie restoration techniques and applying them in Texas. And then maybe some of the lessons about, you know, kind of wider lessons about how we might, you know, rewild our future and maybe build a little bit of a better tomorrow.
Yeah, it's really an interesting book because you managed to go back in history on many occasions and talk about what the land was like before. And the animals, I found that very interesting. And you did have a spot early on where you talked to, you gave a bit of advice in a way about how to find those areas in, you know, anybody's own place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes the easiest way to find these kinds of places is to get a little bit lost, whether accidentally or on purpose, because these kinds of places, the places where wild nature reasserts itself in the city, are usually, or often at least, spaces that aren't really designed for people, or places that people have kind of abandoned active use of. But they're surprisingly easy to find once you learn to look for them. They're, you know, any place where people have stopped paying attention and plants and animals find room to move in, empty lots, old industrial sites, rights of way, the areas around urban creeks and rivers, and, you know, the kind of liminal zones and edges between other land uses, even brownfields that in other areas that have been deemed off limits. And, you know, if you sort of think like an animal might think of where would you go if you wanted to bed down for an evening without being bothered by anybody. That's usually a pretty good guide.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're right that nature, it's more beautiful in places that are damaged and scarred by industrial abuse. Some people might say, well, how can that be? How is it possible?
I think more than anything, when you sort of stumble upon an expanse of native plants that have sort of retaken an empty field around or behind some old abandoned 20th century industrial site, an old gravel pit that was totally trashed out 20 or 30 years ago and has now been kind of fully rewilded, not through any attention from, you know, the Parks Department or the DNR, but just from nature doing its own thing. It's really affirming in the evidence it gives of nature's inherent resilience and ability to adapt to and recover from, you know, the worst we throw at it, or, you know, or other conditions in the climate might throw at it. And so, and it has a kind of a romance, it's like, you know, seeing a coyote crossing the train tracks at the edge of downtown, or, you know, seeing a beautiful raptor, you know, sort of hunting along the tollway at the edge of town. There's a beauty to that and a reminder that, you know, even in the heart of urbanity, where we think we're sort of, you know, trapped in the middle of the human machine, we're actually very connected with nature. And in many cases, you find that, you know, a lot of species of wildlife are making home in the city because it's the only place they have left.
Yeah, I see. But maybe it'd be kind of cool. You do such a nice job of describing some of the areas in Austin. Can you describe some of those areas for us and what you see when you go into them?
Yeah, so a lot of the book is centered on the area where I live, which is just east of downtown Austin, in a zone that's we live on a little like urban acre that's right in the liminal space between a very heavily developed old industrial corridor that's now sort of, you know, slowly transitioning into newer, more kind of new urbanist kinds of uses. And then behind that, a pocket of urban woods along the lower Colorado River, where just a mile or so from us upriver, maybe half a mile, there's the last dam that holds in that river for flood control between here and the Gulf of Mexico, 300 miles downriver. So it's much more like the natural channel of the river. And when you approached it from the street, you might think you were in the weirdest, creepiest, scariest industrial neighborhood you've ever seen. There's like, I've got an abandoned lighting factory and an old 1940s furniture factory, both of which are like covered in graffiti. And there's a kind of a, you know, rundown little, door factory, and then a big old milk plant that has just gone obsolete, and half of those things are like covered in graffiti, and they look like, you know, the set of an apocalypse zombie video game or something. But you go back behind there through the fences, and there's pockets of public land in there. You don't have to trespass to access it, and you know, when you're on the floodplain of a navigable waterway, that's all basically, you know, the commons under the U.S. Constitution. And so you go down in there and you find these swaths of woods that have taken over what 20 or 30 years ago was heavily used for mineral extraction, to drag out river rock, to make aggregate, to make roads, and to make, you know, foundations for tall buildings and whatnot. And in the, you know, and it's tall cottonwoods that, you know, grow the tallest where the big drainage pipes are emptying out. And, you know, and it's just vital habitat for coyotes, foxes, all manner of waterfowl, you know, egrets and herons and venomous snakes. This is Texas, not the Midwest. It's one of the notable differences, right? And you know, raptors, everything from the occasional bald eagle in the winter down here, not in the summer so much, and osprey, you know, the kind of river hawks are down here all winter long, and then all kinds of strange, like, tree-burrowing ducks that come around in the summer, and, you know, kingfisher and whatnot. And so you'll be down in there and you'll, you know, you can still hear some of the sounds of the factories that are active, and you can hear the, you know, trucks rolling down and downshifting on the nearby old bridge, and you can hear the planes coming in to land, and you can also hear the cry of the osprey or the red-shouldered hawk or the quack of the ducks, and maybe when the police sirens start screaming down the boulevard, you'll hear at night, you'll hear the coyotes out in the woods calling back to the sirens as if it's their lost cousin or something. And it's just, it's a kind of a weird, mixed up, you know, Anthropocene reality that we occupy, and I find it to be pretty fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun. I remember you writing about a pepper. This is kind of what it was so interesting about your book. You'll often zero in on a plant or an animal and give us a little history. There was a chilipetin pepper?
Yeah, chiltepinian, or it's often called chili pekin. They're sort of two similar plants that get kind of an interchangeable name. There's this funny little hot pepper that I didn't even know about until I'd been down here for a while, and there was this visiting landscaper, a guy from Indiana who had kind of learned the plant center. He's like, oh, you know what that is? And it turned out it was, yeah, this chili pekin or chiltepin, which is a wild hot pepper that can only germinate after it's been digested by a bird and, you know, and dropped out at the other end of the bird. And it's tiny. It's about the size of like a big teardrop. And it's green until it ripens, and then it turns the red, that kind of red of a jalapeno pepper. And it's really interesting because it's this plant that can only grow wild. So you really only find it in these kinds of empty lot kinds of places, often, you know, under trees or along fence rows, as you might imagine, once you learn how they germinate. And a little research, and I learned that this pepper, that the name comes from the language of the Aztecs, Nahuatl, when it means like flea pepper or meant it to them. And it's the original pepper from which all the other peppers of the North American table have been derived somehow through, you know, human manipulation, even though, you know, through grafting, since you couldn't, you know, you can't grow the plant from a seed. And when you see something, just kind of some scrubby little plant in your yard that might otherwise be unremarkable, and you see the connection it gives you to the deep past of the land, to a past that really even precedes like human habitation of the continent, and a thing that can only grow wild. It's a beautiful discovery, and then you find out how good it tastes, and that you can, you know, make a hot vinegar, you know, that you can put over any meal on your dinner table, and it's kind of like extra credit, and it's the fun of, you know, foraging your own kind of rundown part of town and finding there's all kinds of amazing food to be found.
I thought it was really cool, and the fact that it, I mean, all of our peppers, our bell peppers, our serranos, every pepper we enjoy came from that pepper. I mean, yeah. It makes you look at that plant a whole lot differently. I mean, with some awe.
Yeah, with some absolute awe. That's right. And it helps you think about our connection to the natural world and how much of our reality comes from the ways in which we have figured out how to control the reproduction of other life and, you know, make it serve us. And the way it helps you think about and appreciate the power of those natural wild plants and how connected they are with our original roots as, you know, foragers and hunters.
Yeah. Christopher Brown, our guest today, his book, his new book out, A Natural History, Field Notes, I should say, A Natural History of Empty Lots, Field Notes from Urban Edgelands, Back Alleys, and Other Wild Places. And we're going to give you a chance to join in about now. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get to Merrill and Madison in just a minute. But first, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. talking with Christopher Brown. He authored the book A Natural History of Empty Lots, and I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts about empty lots and what it might mean to you. Do you ignore them? Do you spend some time in them? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Mrill in Madison. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Larry. I love this topic. And Christopher, thank you for writing the book. I think following my dog, I ended up crashing around in a lot of spaces like these. And I found this topic's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I just really appreciate how you're sort of peeling back the layers and realizing there's every one of these places is different and has a story to tell about our history and our relationship with different plants. And I just wanted to follow up with a couple of things for me, because I have thought about this topic a lot. But one is that I think they're kind of like a call to action, because they are sort of ignored spaces. And a lot of the ways we maintain our infrastructure is we purposely exclude with things like fencing and asphalt and pesticides, herbicides. And so the more that we can work with cities and other developers to really think about how to get involved and to encourage more species diversity and to tell the stories of those places. Like just around my own neighborhood, the history of Indian mounds is incredible. And they're really kind of hidden and many are obliterated, but with a little bit of investigation, you can learn so much. So I think there's a really great opportunity. And also a lot of these spaces, the way they're distributed, you know, there can be some ones that are not at all easy to romanticize about, and they tend to be clustered in areas where there are people who have less money, real estate values are lower and stuff like that. So I have really just thought a lot about these spaces. I actually wrote a book a couple years ago called Loving Orphan Space. So I just wanted to download all that because I love this topic. I think it's like an environmental frontier for us.
Morel, thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I completely agree. I think one of the things you find when you start exploring these spaces and seeing how much life they often harbor, how much urban biodiversity there really is in the kind of negative space of the city, you start to connect with this other life around, and then you soon realize how threatened it is by development. Like where we live, it is a historically industrial neighborhood. It's also in the fastest growing city in America, or what it has been for most of the last 15 years. And, you know, development attention is on the neighborhood, and these kinds of ignored spaces are not going to be ignored for long. And, you know, when we live on a planet where, if you can believe the World Wildlife Fund, something like, according to their most recent report, 73% of the vertebrate wildlife population of the planet has disappeared since 1970. And even if that number is wrong, maybe it's half that number, it's an extreme statistic. So thinking about urban biodiversity and how we create more space within the city to, you know, share our habitat with the other life that we share the earth with, I think it's an important undertaking. And I completely agree with your sentiment. And with the history that's around us as well, the indigenous history that's manifest in the land.
Yeah. Morel, thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. I was thinking about the city of Madison, where I am currently broadcasting the show from, and we had an area. The Garver Feed Mill was an old feed mill that was right next to the place called Starkweather Creek. And I would kayak up that Starkweather Creek, and it was as though there were places along, and of course that feed mill had been abandoned for many, 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 many years, but you could kayak up that creek, and it was like you were not in the city anymore. You could still hear a little bit from time to time, but the difference in the wildlife and the plant life in some areas just behind the Garver Mill were really, really different from the rest of the city. Let's put it that way. And finally, the Garver feed mill was, someone bought it and restored it into a very active place with many businesses of kind of, it's now a very beautiful building. But then at the same time, some parts of that back area are gone. And, you know, I like the Garver feed mill. I like to go over there. There's a pizza place and there's a lot of places where you can have fun and enjoy the mill. But at the same time, if you're kayaking up the Starkweather Creek, you're seeing something a little different.
Yeah, I mean, having there are places like that, I think, in every city. I mean, like, I grew up in Des Moines, and it was like that up along the Raccoon River where there wasn't a lot of flood control. And yet there were lots of industrial uses, but they just couldn't keep out the wild activity. And that's the same kind of thing here. And people, you can do that in Houston. You can even go paddle the Gowanus Canal in New York if you don't mind the toxins in the water. And it's astonishing how many places there are like this in every city. And to your point, if you know, usually they're created through inattention, right? Almost by accident. They're kind of like involuntary parks created through, obsolescence of an old industrial activity. And there are ways they can be preserved while redeveloping, you know, a zone in a way that maintains some of that wild character. And I think it's important to get people more excited about that, because when people can experience wild nature without having to, go very far from their own home, I think it really changes how they think about their relationship with the natural world and just enriches life.
Yeah.
Period.
Let's go to John in Spooner. John, hello. Thank you for calling.
You bet. Hey, what a great show, as always, Larry. But like I was telling you, your interviewer there before, I'm fortunate enough to make it to 75 years old. I grew up on the north side of Milwaukee. And my little brother and I used to spend a lot of time creeping around in old abandoned factories, and lots where factories had been torn down, and building rafts out of barrels and whatnot, floating around in ponds on, pretending we were Huckleberry Finn and whatnot. But your subject is brought back just a flood of childhood memories that were just wonderful.
Oh, John, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Christopher?
I think that's where I learned it as a kid. You know, I think it's been amazing to me with this book and the sort of invitation it gives to find out. Half the people you talk to are like, oh, yeah, man, I spent my whole childhood, you know, exploring places like that. Because I think we all, as children, we sort of have a natural attraction to and wonder of wild nature, and we just instinctively seek it out. We know that kind of real life, as it were, isn't to be found at the mall, you know, or on a downtown sidewalk, but in these little spaces where nature is allowed to express itself to some degree in the city. And rediscovering that as an adult is really like a secret password to kind of opening up whole other aspects of life. So I think whether you're 25 or 75, getting out there and rediscovering, you know, shortcuts into empty lots like you might have done when you're a kid, you might find it's a pretty fun thing, whether you have a kayak or just 2 feet.
Jim emailed to say Chernobyl, and you write about this briefly in the book, Chernobyl is a good example of nature's reclamation. The Babushkas of Chernobyl is an interesting documentary that follows a group of elderly women who went back to live in Chernobyl's prohibited zone, and worth checking out. But that's what you would call an involuntary park.
Right, an involuntary park. It's a term that was coined by my friend, the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling, to describe these kinds of places where the rewilding happens because they're so damaged by human activity that literally there can be no human occupation. And so the most typical kind of American example is, you know, a brownfield, a place where there's, you know, enough toxic contamination that it's not really fit for active human use, you know, your prototypical Superfund site. But also, yeah, places like the Chernobyl exclusion zone where radioactive contamination has kept people out to a large extent for a long time. And there, the rewilding has been really kind of remarkable and extreme. And you can go, yeah, that documentary I haven't seen, but there are a number of sources where you can find windows into that and lots of other folks who have written about some of those kinds of sites.
Yeah, I remember a Sports Illustrated article on the wildlife of Chernobyl and how it came back, and absolutely amazing, and how the land, the plants and everything else is just sort of reclaiming that area, just like it has happened in our own country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Victoria in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, just a couple of things. My first thing was, I know that the speaker had mentioned, like, you know, the Wildlife Federation and their documentation on species loss and how he said it might be less. I disagree. I feel like it might be more than being documented because, you know, humans have definitely done a number on the planet. So I just kind of wanted to put that out there for people to kind of mull over. And then the other thing was, how people in the community, especially these lower income communities that aren't as fortunate, can get involved in protecting these wild places. Because, you know, a lot of the times, as someone who I work in natural resources, I'm, you know, pursuing a degree in sustainable agriculture. A lot of these disturbed areas get taken over by invasive species, mostly like plants and stuff. So how do we get involved as a community in making sure that, like, native plants are being put in, or we're saving these spaces for, you know, the wildlife that is left. So I just was wondering if he had any comment about how community can get involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, on both, I'll speak to both of those questions. I mean, I completely agree with you, Victoria, about the biodiversity laws. But I'm not a natural scientist. I'm a writer and a lawyer, so I don't feel qualified to definitively opine. And I think the Living Planet report from the World Wildlife Foundation just came out a month ago, and that's the one with the 73% global number. There are, you know, debates over how you go about measuring that, but I think we can all agree that the biodiversity loss in our lifetimes is profound and like a major wake-up call we all need to give attention to, and that's a big part of what I'm trying to talk about in the book. With respect to your great point about how often these kinds of wild urban spaces that are, you know, unintentionally wild or, you know, kind of wild without the active attention of, you know, municipal or state authorities trying to steward them. It's so true, and it's very much the case in my neighborhood that there are ways in which communities and whether it's just a group of neighbors or, you know, more organized community groups can go about trying to protect these kinds of spaces from the worst industrial abuses, trying to help conserve them and set aside and protect, you know, pockets of these from development, and try to go about the active work of restoration. I do a lot of work along those lines here, working with, you know, my neighbors here in, you know, what's a historically a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood of Austin, and a lot of working class folks, a lot of families of recent immigrants, a lot of people who self-identify as indigenous. And I wouldn't be able to live on this old brownfield lot I live on if there hadn't been a group of folks who organized to shut down a big above-ground petroleum tank farm in the 90s that was, you know, leaking benzene into the soil and harming its neighbors. And we have groups like Ecology Action, an old recycling nonprofit that I'm on the board of here, and we've pivoted to now operating the restoration of a 10-acre brownfield in urban East Austin, where there was a municipal landfill. There's so much methane in the soil that they won't let us do controlled burns because it's not safe. But we've turned it back into this gorgeous, you know, urban prairie. And there's just examples of things like that all over the country. And, you know, lots of people just doing their own backyard rewilding projects and taking some of the lessons that we have, you know, especially in the Midwest, where there's really the pioneers of like prairie restoration. And you can take those lessons and apply them on, you know, much smaller pockets of land and achieve kind of, you know, islands of biodiversity within the city that connect to each other on their own. And the outcomes can be magnificent.
Yeah. Victoria, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to turn to your home, your house and property for a minute or two or more. Can you talk about the, you know, sort of the background, how you landed where you are? And then I'd love to have you talk about the building of your house and how you tried to work nature into your home.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, in the late 2000s, and I was in my early 40s, and I found myself as a middle-aged bachelor, a half-time single dad, renting an apartment downtown, and I had been spending all this time exploring these kinds of spaces, and I was like, well, here I am. Maybe there's a way to live in one, and also, you know, lower my overhead and try to, you know, kind of reinvent domestic life a little bit. And so I started looking around and I found this funny little urban acre that was a quasi brownfield. It had an old petroleum pipeline from this tank farm I was just describing to Victoria, diagonally bisecting it with a big valve box right in the middle, like a steel box with a kind of wheel in it, like you'd find on the hatch of a ship, as if you could open up some secret portal into the earth. And then it was just covered in all kinds of trash, you know, a lot of like construction and demolition debris, big chunks of concrete and rebar, even entire like curb cuts and whatnot. And yet it was also wild, and it was next to these urban woods, and it was, you know, it had access to the river. And so I was like, well, this is a crazy project, kind of, you know, might be kind of challenging, but it was just sort of intrinsically compelling. And so I worked with the oil company that had built that pipeline to take the pipeline out, and which was easier than you might think. And then I worked with some architects to come up with a design for a house that tried to really, like, make it more about landscape than about house, and basically bury a little house that wasn't any bigger than my apartment down in the ditch where this pipeline had been, with a green roof, and that kind of opened up to the woods, hidden from the street, and set up so that to go from room to room, you have to step outside. It's just like three rooms around a courtyard, you know, which may sound a little crazy if you're in Wisconsin in November, but this is Texas where, you know, we didn't really ever get super cold. And even then, you know, there's kind of a rigor to, you know, stepping outside even on a winter day to go get a cup of coffee in the morning or whatever. And doing green roofs in Texas is challenging. It's much easier to do up north. In Texas, we have such a harsh summer that it's really hard for the plants to endure. But the secret is you just put the native drought-resistant plants of the prairie on your roof. So we did just that, working with friends from the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center down here in Austin. And, you know, managed to have a successional blackland prairie growing on our roof, and the result is like really like a rewilded house where we just have every manner of critter walking up, you know, in the crepuscular hours to see what's up, from the raptors to the urban canids to the snakes who come in to hunt the lizards that live in the roof. So.
It is amazing. And you describe, there was a funny story. You do learn then about the creatures that are around your home when you do something like this. And you talked about harvester ants. And learning about them, and yeah, kind of an amusing in a way story about the oil line.
Yeah, well, yeah, I described how, you know, there was that big valve box for the pipeline that, and so this like steel box, and right next to that steel box is this giant denuded area made by a colony of harvester ants, which are these really big ants. Their heads are like the size of lentils, very Texas kind of creature. And they are trail builders. They like to collect seeds, and they build these little like trails through the wild grasses to send out their foragers and bring them back. You don't want to mess with them because they've got one of the most venomous bites of any insect in North America, as I have found on a couple of occasions. But what's really remarkable about them is I learned after, you know, I'd seen this pipeline removal crew try to, you know, deal with them as a biohazard and then give up and then just bury them in dirt, learning that there were probably 150,000 inhabitants in this colony that went 16 feet into the earth, seeing the home building crew struggling with them as well, and somehow these ants survive. And then I learned that they regulate the comings and goings of their forager ants with a method that is algorithmically identical to TCP/IP, the packet switching protocol used to regulate the movement of data over the internet, where like the number of ants that are sent out by the colony are dispatched based on the speed with which ants are coming back with food. And one of those astonishing ways in which you learn that, you know, we mimic nature and or these patterns we think we have invented are all over nature. And hilariously, yeah, like we had put our, you know, internet router right in a little utility closet right next to where the mound was. So they're amazing creatures.
They are indeed. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling, Karen.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the Garver feed mill. That's my backyard now. I remember when red dot potato chip blew up, it was fire. But before that, last year I went down there in a kayak down Starkweather Creek and found muskrats and a couple animals were still, they're still living down there. There just aren't so many frogs and things around here anymore, I noticed.
Yeah. Karen, thank you very much for calling. So back to my comment earlier of the Garber feed mill and her comment about the fact there's still wildlife there, but changes as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everything's constantly changing. I mean, you know, up there where y'all live, you can go read the works of folks like Frances Hammerstrom, the amazing naturalist who was the only female protege of Aldo Leopold and kind of one of the, like, you know, protectors of the prairie chicken. But she writes extensively about all the wild food she learned how to harvest from the urban and suburban landscape of Wisconsin. She even has a book called The Wild Food Cookbook that's a terrific and rich depiction of, you know, that, and even like recipes you can try if you want to see what the muskrat might taste like if you're so inclined. But, and I think, you know, you talk about feed mills, I think they're really interesting places. They're like really ubiquitous in the Midwestern landscape. And as I try to articulate in the book, they're also a kind of, you know, testament to, you know, they're really the foundation, the lodestones, the foundation stones of civilization in the way, because when you kind of think about how our entire civilization is really founded on this ability to control the reproduction of other life, in particular, the discovery in the Fertile Crescent of the Neolithic era of the ability to control the reproduction of grain plants, to be able to accumulate stores of grain that we can keep for, you know, the seasons when we need it. And the way that evolved into wealth and the way that provided, you know, really the foundation of civilization and all of the great things about it, but also, you know, a lot of the challenging things about it, like, you know, the things we do to control each other, to work the fields, or the, you know, the way wealth gets unequally distributed and whatnot. And so it's kind of cool seeing rewilded landscapes around feed mills and, you know, grain silos and things like that, because I think it's a sort of conceptually powerful thing to kind of witness, even without having to actively think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Christopher Brown, our guest, the book, A Natural History of Empty Lots. As we talk with him, you can join in, too. We had some great comments so far. What about you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking with Christopher Brown about the book that he's written. It's titled A Natural History of Empty Lots. Fascinating book. And again, comments or experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Chris, you just mentioned or made comment to growing up in the Midwest, and you describe in your book growing up in the Midwest around the grain silos and the farm building and the endless fields, everything green, everything alive, but somehow lifeless. What'd you mean by that?
I mean, there's a way in which, you know, growing up in the, I grew up in Iowa, the gateway to Wisconsin, and it was, you know, you're taught that if you want to see wildlife, you get out of the city and you go out to the country, and then you go out there. And I think it's especially true in a place like Iowa, which is so completely focused on production agriculture in most of the counties. And, you know, and all you find are, you know, rows and rows of crops, which, you know, when I was a kid, they were mostly just making grain for feed and maybe some for folks. Now a lot of it is going to make fuel for machines. And wildlife is largely confined to the, you know, kind of the fence rows. And, you know, and even I remember, you know, there were pictures my dad had of, you know, going pheasant hunting in the places we lived as a kid, and there were a lot more pheasant when he was a kid than I ever saw, and you'd only rarely see one, you know, kind of like down in the ditch along the road. And so I found, even as a kid, that, like, I saw more wildlife or got more a sense of the wild in urban forests and along urban rivers and in little prairie remnants at the edge of town where, you know, the city hadn't fully overtaken it yet, and there wasn't any active agricultural use. And so, you know, seeing how, you know, how much we've changed the landscape outside of the city, and seeing how, you know, the ways in which there as well, you can start to find ways to rewild it. There's a lot going on with these kinds of prairies that people are doing, you know, partly subsidized by the ag department. But yeah, I just found, you know, all through my life that counterintuitively, you know, we think the wilderness is out there, but really, especially in the agricultural Midwestern landscape, it's in the edges of the cities.
Yeah. And in the rural areas, the farm areas, it used to be along the fence rows, which have been, with larger farms, have kind of been eliminated in many, many areas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you go into, like, the northern parts of Iowa now, and where I still have good friends, and it's kind of like they, like, took out all the fence rows, and they have, you know, it's like, I almost think it's like these, like, giant robots just kind of, you know, it's where this glacial landscape that's so, like, tabletop flat, it's just like, yeah, there's just not a lot of room for anything but making money, right, off the land. And having spaces for other life to make room is really important to kind of be in balance.
Steve in Rockton, Illinois, up next. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, as I'm listening to Christopher and the previous caller, I believe her name was Victoria from up north, I'm reminded of these spaces being open to cultivation. And I thought of the idea of guerrilla gardening and potentially, you know, folks that discover these areas that are open and unused to establishing food forests and getting into permaculture, things like, hazelnuts possibly, or raspberries, things that would provide these folks that enjoy these areas a food source in a sort of set it and forget it wildlife reclamation. I think it would dovetail quite nicely. And as to the, I believe it was Victoria, she asked how to get involved. If someone's got a green thumb and gets into air layering for something like hazelnuts.
Hey, there you go. Well, Christopher, comment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, driving this morning, I right before I got on to join you, I saw a guy out foraging for pecans on an empty lot. It's like a place where there used to be a truck spring shop until about 6 months ago, and they tore it down to make room for who knows what's coming. But there's like three tall pecans here in an area that once was like a pecan forest, basically, you know, 200 years ago. And, you know, very Thanksgiving-themed activity, this guy with a plastic bag foraging pecans. And that idea of urban foraging and guerrilla gardening, there's a lot of power to that, and there's a lot of people doing it. I mean, I have a buddy, a writer, who has rewilded a little tiny patch of urban dirt under the elevated M train in Queens, New York, where he's planted these native wildflowers of, you know, of that region of New York, and probably not with, you know, permission from the borough authorities. And it's really gorgeous. And yeah, people can absolutely grow wild native foods that are also vibrant food sources. They can get into the work of trying to manage the invasives that tend to crowd out the native plants and get involved with groups that are doing more like coordinated prairie restoration and urban native landscape restoration. And it's a really rewarding work.
Yeah, it is. And Steve, thank you for that call. Eleanor and Madison, we can maybe wind up kind of with you. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I also live in Madison, and, you know, the Oscar Mayer plant, it's a 1.5 million square foot, largely empty building, 70 acres, 3 miles from city center with 30 plus developable acres. It's on a bike path, it's on a highway, it's on a railroad. And it seems to me like such a wasted opportunity for issues like this. So my question is, how do we balance the responsibility of developers and local governments to sort of step in and sort of have a say in this rewilding effort?
It's such a great question, and it's something I've worked on a lot down here. And we have found, you know, that most developers approached right are interested in figuring out ways to have some measure of, you know, wild landscape restoration. We've worked with a lot of riverfront developers in zones where there are zoning rules that help us get some leverage with them. But we've even worked with folks like the Tesla factory. Elon Musk built this, you know, Tesla built this huge gigafactory just downriver from us. And we were able to work with them to at least work to restore the riparian corridor of what had been an old gravel pit where they built their factory. And in the United Kingdom, the conservative government there earlier this year before the elections, they put in place new rules that require nationwide for any new real estate development bigger than one single family home, the developer has to demonstrate after the completion of the project a 10% net gain in biodiversity. And, you know, my reaction is if they can do it there, surely we can do it here, where the erasure of the native landscape is so much more recent as anybody who, you know, has grown up in the Midwest or in Texas knows. I mean, you leave a little urban ditch alone and suddenly these, you know, native flowers will start appearing or native grasses will start appearing. And I think there are ways we can do it. We just need to make it a priority. And that starts with people waking up to the bounty of wild habitat that exists inside the cities.
And on that note, I want to thank you so much, Christopher, for being with us today. I really enjoyed your book, and obviously a lot of interest in it. And I hope we get a chance to visit again. Thank you so much.
I would love that, Larry. Thank you so much, and thanks to your listeners.
Christopher Brown's book is titled A Natural History of Empty Lots. Really fascinating read, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Coming up, we're going to talk about converting single-use plastics into renewable energy and other things. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we've got another guest for you. And our guest believes that much of the waste in our landfills, including a lot of single-use plastic, could be converted into renewable energy. Sort of a circular and sustainable bioeconomy, I think is how she puts it. And the she is Erica Majumder, who is an assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. Her lab in the Department of Bacteriology is concerned with the mechanisms and the consequences of microbes on environmental and human health. And as we talk with her about some really cool research, she's got a number of projects going, and I want to try and touch on all of them. And we're going to start with some work that she's done with landfills, but you may have questions about bioplastics and microplastics, or those plastics that we call them single use. And that means that they get used once and they get thrown away. And she's trying to figure out ways that we can come up with a different kind of one-time plastic that can also be eaten up by microbes, let's put it that way. As we talk with her, please do join in. What questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Erica, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you work in the area called landfill microbiology, and it's kind of a new field, isn't it?
Relatively. I think it's gained new traction recently. There was a lot of good work in the 70s and 80s, but there hasn't been very much recently. But we've been reinvigorated to get back into this space.
Well, it involves studying microbes that are maybe deep in the bowels of landfills. What are you hoping to learn?
Sure. Well, a landfill is all about decomposition, and that's all done by microbes. And so we want to learn more about which microbes are there and what they're doing so that we can better control the degradation rates, maybe produce renewable energy, get rid of some of the contaminants, make space. Landfills are often filling up, and we don't want to use a lot of extra land for landfills. So there's incentives to have landfills work more efficiently as well.
And you and your grad students, a whole team of students, are doing something called bioprospecting at the Dane County landfill. And so bioprospecting, is that what you just described?
Kind of. We like to put a lot of different titles on things as the words get popular over time. But yeah, bioprospecting is this idea that in a particular environment where there are chemical constraints on the system, or a unique environment, you could call it, that the microbes that live there probably have adapted to have unique abilities that match that environment. And if we're looking for a microorganism that could help us do a particular function, we go look in environments that are chemically similar. So a landfill is kind of one of the craziest environments I've ever worked in. It's everything's in there. And so we were looking for microbes that might have some unique chemistries with degrading plastics or degrading some of the other wastes that are in a landfill that we don't see in a natural environment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What I was reading the story about you and your work a bit, I thought back to a book Merlin Sheldrake wrote. It was titled Entangled Life. And they, in that book, he describes in one place where it involves some research in Mexico, where I think 15% of, or 10% of the landfill consisted of dirty diapers. And they came up with a white rot fungi that could eliminate 85, would loved diapers, and produced actual edible mushrooms of a sort, but reduced the extent of it by about 85% of the mass. And that's kind of what you're doing, we're looking to do anyway.
Yeah, in a way, definitely. There's a lot of great scientists who are coming up with innovative waste solutions like that, where we're using these natural processes that microorganisms have, which include fungi and archaea and bacteria and even viruses, how they all contribute to these processes. And so it's kind of looking at waste as food for the microorganisms and having those microorganisms produce something that's useful to us, whether that, like the example you just gave, where it's edible mushrooms or could be useful products, all kinds of different things.
Yeah. Well, the Dane County landfill, I have to tell you a little story about that. I did not like the Dane County landfill, where the location where it went in, because when I was a teenager, for a couple of years, I lived on the Rodefeld farm. And so I planted with a couple of brothers, Jerry and Dick Rodefeld, we planted about 1,000 trees in that property. I think I shot the first goose I ever shot hunting as a teenager. I shot in the little pond out in the back of that farm. But then it went to be it was sold to be a landfill, which I deeply didn't like at the time, because I thought, all the trees are now gone and everything. So, but I guess it has to go somewhere.
Yeah, landfills do have to go somewhere. And I think one thing that's really interesting about the Dane County landfill is that they do a lot to be holistic with it. So the closed part of the landfill, they actually use as a prairie seeding grounds. So they'll mm-hmm. seed native grasses to restore those on the closed part of the landfill. So they do try to use the space effectively.
And I'm a golfer, too, and now the other part of the landfill is going to go on part of the golf course that I play on all the time.
I did hear that, yes, that there were some golfers that weren't thrilled about the new location. But yeah, putting a landfill in different places, landfills are very essential to, keeping, a healthy environment, but nobody wants the landfill, in different places. So it's always a tricky discussion of where that goes.
Not my backyard kind of thing.
Exactly.
Well, here you are. Somebody, I probably was a reporter, or maybe not, coined the phrase for you as the landfill lady. What do you what do you think about that?
I've said before, I'm mostly okay with it. At first, I thought it was a little bit of like a Sesame Street Oscar the Grouch kind of reference. And I was like, hopefully it's not that. But then I was informed, I haven't seen Sesame Street in a while. I'm not. I was informed that Oscar recycles now and that he's no longer grouchy. So I needed to update my references there. But it's kind of nice to be associated with, what you research and things like that. But the exact moniker, I don't know if I like it, but it was, I didn't realize they were going to use that for the title of one of the articles about me, but it's nice to be recognized, I guess, for what you do.
Well, let's talk about plastics for a minute here, because if you went to the Dane County landfill or any other landfill, you're going to find, you found a lot of plastic that hadn't degraded an inch, but I mean about 20%?
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources puts out waste audit reports of landfills across the state every year, those are all publicly available. And Wisconsin landfills on average are about 19 to 20% plastic.
And I think there was a little story you told about digging something. I mean, plastic you can dig up that was 30 years ago.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Parts of the landfill are about as old as I am, or a little younger. And yeah, there were plastics that I recognized from my childhood that were easily recognizable with
Hostess Twinkies
brownie package. Yeah, specifically was one of them, and some face creams that I recognized from when I was a teenager, and you know, the blue of the packaging was still just immediately recognizable.
So wow, and so you were, and by the way, as well, we might also say that Wisconsin has a pretty big plastics industry in the state. Right? How big is it?
I should know those numbers.
It was over $2 billion.
Yes, it's very significant, which I was not aware of until I started working in this space. But yeah, it's a major industry here in Wisconsin.
And I'm told that about 45,000 people are working in the plastics industry in our state. So it's a big deal here in Wisconsin. So we can come up with ways to make better plastic.
Yeah, I'd be very excited about that. and I think also that's the way of the future. And the plastics companies in Wisconsin have been leaders and innovators for a long time. And so polymers are always changing in composition. As we've got new polymers over the decades, they've changed. What we use in our plastics change. And so I'm optimistic that plastics of the future will include a lot of these biodegradable solutions as well.
Fran in Madison has a comment or question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I observe many times when we're driving that the cement companies actually have grinders for concrete that they recycle. Why cannot be used to recycle, grind it down to as far as you can for all this garbage? I don't understand why the trucks dump loads and loads of it, and it can't be reduced to at least 50% of its volume by putting it through some heavy grinders. I mean, if they can grind cement for reuse, why can't we grind up all this
plastic
and cardboard? I mean, it's unbelievable when you go to the that lab that circulates around. It's called Junk Lab or something.
The trash lab, yeah.
The stuff that actually goes in the garbage is just absolutely disgusting.
All right, well, go ahead, Erica, comment away.
Sure, yeah, there's a couple of perspectives you could take there. I like that you're thinking about reuse for materials and how we might be able to replace new materials with what we already have. On the grinding question, so the landfills here, when the trucks dump things, there's a whole process of using these giant bulldozers that actually have metal wheels instead of rubber wheels, and they compact the trash, and there's a very specific way of compacting the trash, and so they're able to do that without grinding. Grinding consumes a lot of energy, so when we're looking at sustainability solutions, it's always this trade-off between how much energy and cost and the benefit to that. So for materials that go into landfills, the compaction that they do is probably more efficient in terms of than grinding. But I do like your question because that brings up a lot of things about waste diversion and what wastes go into landfills and how we can use those materials. So our local landfills here in Dane County, they do divert a lot of waste, like the construction and demolition waste diversion, the tire waste diversion. So they collect all of those materials separately and they reuse them and recycle them like you've seen with the grinding, which is great. And I wish we could do that more with plastics. There are some examples that I've heard about at some Wisconsin innovation things that I've attended where for road construction, they've been taking waste plastics and condensing them into large blocks and putting them under roads instead of extra gravel or dirt, which is more which is great that they're using these waste plastics in that way. And so, yeah, I'd love to see more innovation on that front.
For sure. And Dan and Brilliant, we'll get to you in just a minute, but we're taking a look at some research being done by Erica Majumdar, who is our guest today, as she talks about her research, a little different than what we just talked about, because she's looking at bioplastics, which are a different thing kind of entirely from the petroleum-based plastics that currently go into these plastics that kind of live forever. And we'll talk about that. And Dan and Brilliant, we'll get to you in just a minute. But a quick reminder, you're listening to WPR News, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Erica Majumder, who's an assistant professor of bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology, doing some research in landfills, and especially zeroing in on plastics today. And I hope you'll join in. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And let's go to Dan and Brilliant. Dan, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was just tuning in. I'm actually a garbage man that frequents landfills pretty frequently. I'm on route right now, actually. And, yeah, these landfills are way more than just places where we dump our trash. And it's amazing to see the work that goes into these landfills and the science and research that's done even after the landfill is completely closed and all the operational side of things packs up. Scientists stay for decades after doing the work that you do. It's just, and it's such a great place for biodiversity, too. Like, one of the landfills I used to dump at when I worked on the other side of the state was a home for at least a dozen bald eagles.
Yeah.
And they never left. So it's incredible
pretty
to see the difference in biodiversity and what animals are attracted to this
area. Yeah, Dan, thanks a lot for calling. Just a comment on that, Erica.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for the work that you do and for listening and calling in and your perspective on it. It's true. When I started working in the landfill, just thinking about the microbiology, I had no idea about all of the other infrastructure and really actually the incredible work and resource that a landfill is for a city and a locality. So, yeah. Thank you. And yes, the eagles are amazing. I also did not expect to see a lot of wildlife at a landfill. And yeah, the eagle watching at landfills is fantastic.
And seagulls.
Yes.
They come from everywhere.
The seagulls too. Yeah, I visited a landfill in North Carolina and they had a bunch of eagles there too. And I did not expect that. So,
thanks, Dan. I appreciate the call. Tom in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was listening in. I've got a couple of opinions. I was in the plastics industry for a good 40 years. I'm retired. I retired like 9 years ago, so I'm sure things have caught up a little bit. But I was pretty involved in recycling and things like that. And one of the problems, I think the biggest problem is there's no streams out there. The streams to get rid of the plastics, I used to feel the same way. I mean, we were fortunate in the sense that we were doing food-grade plastic, and so our rejected plastic, you know, was, you know, minute little particles of contamination and stuff, so they could take that plastic and easily make something else out of it. So we had a stream for our waste. But the biggest problem is that people just there's not enough of industry for recycling and getting the streams going and separating your plastics. Europe is way far ahead of us than in that regard. They've been recycling for a long time. They are probably making more things out of their products, but we have to come up with ways. You know, we did some experimenting with trying to get plastics to degrade. You know, guys would take them home and bury them in their garden for a year and stuff and dig them up, and yeah, they weren't much different. You know, it's a hard thing to do, and I don't know how much has progressed in the last 9 years, but to me the more important thing seems to be, let's take the plastic we already have and find uses for it in recycling. And it was always crazy that when you would recycle, things would be so much more expensive. It's kind of like, well, geez, the main portion of the product that you need, you're getting, you know, you're almost getting for free. Why is this so expensive? But I know the process can be expensive.
Well, and you know, that's what you're working on in a lot of ways. Yes. Erica.
Yeah, thank you for your comment and your perspective. I completely agree. I think there's an abundance of material available, and it's disappointing to me that we don't capitalize on all of that material that's available. And sometimes, as you were alluding to, even when there is a feasible chemical or engineering solution, sometimes the economics prevents us from using that, and then it just ends up in a landfill, which I agree is a shame. So I have recently there, like in the last few years, I've seen more of an emphasis on people starting to get creative about the different ways to use plastics. And I mean, plastics are a super useful material. That's why we use them all the time. They're very practical. And I think there's a lot of creative uses for how we could recycle and reuse the plastic material that's out there.
And now what you're looking at, though, is the creation of, well, you would like to see plastics made from organic material.
Yeah, ideally. So I would say both ways. So existing plastic waste or... but my lab's done a little bit of that. We've done some waste PET or polyethylene terephthalate, like water bottle kind of plastic conversion. But we've done a lot of work on taking the leftovers from food production. So we don't want to mess with the like the crops or the part of the crops that go to food. But there's all of that plant that gets left over, or there's all the animal waste that gets left over, or... as those raw materials become the part of the food that we eat, there's other waste streams that come off of that. And so we've been trying to use all of that carbon and feed it to our microbes and produce biodegradable plastic polymers.
And the problem has been with the biodegradable polymers is that they're not as rigid, or they're, I think the petroleum-based are sturdier? Is that, am I right on that or not?
It depends on the polymer. So for a lot of the bioplastics, the main type of polymer is called a class called polyhydroxyalkanoates, or PHAs for short. And the main one that's produced commercially right now is called PHB. And it's a good replacement for polypropylene, but it can be a little brittle. And so it has very limited applications because it can be so brittle. So you can't do it for anything flexible like food packaging or things like that. So petroleum-based polymers have this wider range of mechanical properties that can be used. And so we try to, we've been actually sourcing some different types of waste streams from the dairy industry to try to make our bioplastic polymers be more flexible by incorporating some of the molecules that are in dairy waste.
Yeah, whey, I think, are a part of whey.
Whey is one of them, but specifically the acid whey we've been using, but you can also use sweet whey. And one of the great things about moving to Wisconsin is I've learned so much about dairy processing as well. And so sometimes we've been even trying with different streams like permeates and buttercream separated whey and all these different kinds of things that I didn't know existed. But
But using them as a way to make this new product?
Yeah, exactly. So these would be like waste streams for the companies, or co-products or residues is typically what we call them, not waste streams. They are great food for our microorganisms, but less good food for people or animals. We feed them these molecules and our bacteria produce polymers from those molecules.
Mike in Madison has something that relates to just what you said. Mike, let's go there. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, so as we head into all these plastic cars now, and especially the electric cars that are like 80%, plastic and going to fill up our landfills, quadruple the amount in the next 20 years. My question is there specific types of plastic that this bacteria prefers to eat? Any of our like nylons or of the poly blends? I know there's a couple different bacteria that around the world that I've read about that are eating up these plastics, but they never say what they never get to too much technical data on. What are the plastics are they eating? Are they prefer, you know, Lycra, nylon, the infinite number of plastics we have in the planet now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that brings up a lot of issues with plastic degradation. So, yeah, plastics are a huge chemical. There's so many different types of plastics, many different polymers. They can be in blends. They can be in layered packaging. So it's a very challenging degradation as well as chemical recycling problem. Yeah, a lot of times they don't say which plastics the microbes are eating because sometimes they don't know, or they maybe don't want to admit that when plastics get formulated, it's not just the polymer. There are these other small molecules that get mixed into the blend that becomes the plastic to give it the correct properties, and we call these other molecules additives. And what we found in our research and from the microorganisms in the Dane County landfill is that they're dominantly consuming these additives that are in the plastics, and they're not really eating the polymer. That can be tricky for a couple of reasons, but there are some microbes that can eat particular polymers. Microbes have been pretty good at eating PET, or the polyethylene terephthalate, from water bottles is the most common use of that. And they're pretty good at eating things that are like polyester based, so things that are labeled as biodegradable or home compostable plastics would be made out of polyesters. Microbes are less good at eating things like nylon or olefins, which would be like polyethylene and polypropylene, that have carbon-carbon linkages in the polymer. Sorry, I'm a chemist. I went down that route, but
that's all right. That's all right. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Again, I was thinking about some research. You know, these organisms can learn how to like something and to use it, and it sometimes takes a while. And I remember some research. A guy was, for some reason, decided that with the millions and billions of cigarette butts and filters, he taught... Well, he got working with microbes and found some that just loved them and ate them up.
Yeah.
But it took a while. It took a week or a couple of weeks for them to sort of warm up to the idea of eating them. But once they did, they just were ravenous.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the cigarette butts, I think it's actually a similar one to the diaper. It's the same microbe as the diaper example that you gave. But yeah, they microbes can learn how to do these things. And that was one of the reasons we were looking in the landfill, is because there's a time element where the microbes have that time to learn how to do something. So.
Very cool. David in northern Wisconsin will give you a chance. Hi, David.
Hi. Hello. I called because it was several years ago, maybe two, three, something like that, where I saw a video on the internet, or else it was an article that I read, where somebody had a invention where he returned the plastic to its original oil composition, and it was something like in an African village, and then they were using that the product there for their utilitarian uses in that area. And I was wondering if the lady, I don't know her name, I just tuned in later, knew anything about it. And I've always wondered for these several years, ever since I discovered or learned about that, if we can so easily, because it wasn't a very complex process going on there, if we can so easily turn the plastics back into original composition oil, petroleum that it was made out of, why don't we do that?
Hmm. Erica, what do you think?
good question. I'm not familiar with that particular example, but it sounds fascinating. There's even here at UW-Madison, there's a whole center. The acronym is CUP, for chemical upcycling of waste plastics. And so we do think a lot about that. And it would be great to have plastics that we could convert back into their oils or use. My guess is that would have been a very particular type of plastic that they were using, but I'm not familiar with the process. But 100% agree, we should do more of that.
David, thank you. Alex in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Erica. Thank you for this conversation. It's fascinating. The past 10 or 15 years, I've been hearing not just about microbes, but also fungi. Came in late to the conversation here, but I'm very curious on where that direction is going with using different mushrooms and mycelium, and if there's any benefits for using, you know, bacteria versus a fungus like oyster mushrooms and other types of mushrooms that I have heard to break down different types of polymers, but also styrofoam as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, thank you. We think a lot about this, actually. So in our research and others from around the world, what we've been seen is that if you want to fully break down a plastic, that you would need multiple types of microorganisms working together as a community or functional guilds, if you wanted to use labor analogies. And fungi are a huge part of that. Fungi are really good at breaking down bigger structures. And so bacteria are specialists in small molecule metabolism, and fungi are much better at breaking down larger structures. And so we kind of envision a scenario where the fungi would be breaking the plastics down into small enough pieces or releasing the smaller molecules. Fungi are much better at depolymerization, particularly for big intact plastics, because those are big plastics are too big to go inside of a bacteria. And so that means any of that breaking down part, at least initially, would have to happen outside of the cell, which is a very challenging problem for a bacteria. But fungi are much better at that. Examples are like the white rot fungi. Those are the fungi that break down like trees when they fall in the forest. Those mm-hmm. have a lot of the same enzymes that can help us break down polymers. And then once those polymers, and even the same way a log degrades in a forest, the bacteria then eat the smaller pieces that the fungi have broken down. So it's a team effort.
A team effort. Alex, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Dennis had emailed to say they've heard about microbes consuming oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. Are these similar chemicals?
They are, yeah. Great question. So petroleum-based plastics are just oil that have been crystallized. And so and microbes, many different types of microbes, fungi, bacteria, archaea, are capable of depolymerizing oil. The challenge, and so the same metabolism in theory should work. The challenge is with plastics that it, since it's been formed into this hard, rigid, smooth structure, the enzymes that the oil degrading microbes use can't access the correct geometry to do the chemical reaction that they need to break it down. So that's the challenge of the plastic, is that you have to release the polymer to be free enough for the chemistry to happen. But yes, the oil degrading microbes could very easily act on plastics if we can get around the crystallinity.
John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. So last night I was watching a program. It was a response, an ex-executive response from Amazon, who was working on or trying to get the company to pay attention and do a lot to destroy these plastics. And Amazon resisted, whatever. And the same, and they kind of went after Apple, too, because of all the disposable sort of turnover with these products that can't be recycled. And it was very interesting that Amazon did, after a while, and I don't know how long, but is making a concerted effort that in 10 years all of its products will be degradable. I just thought that I would share that, and it was a very interesting thing to watch, and I don't know which channel or which whatever, but I think if you did, someone did a look up and said Amazon's attempt at degradable plastics or something, might get that information.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling. Erica, are you familiar or aware of that work?
Not that specific one, but there are a number of larger companies that are starting to make these promises, or we've already seen reductions in packaging, or trying to think about using less plastic in the packaging. And I think all of this is part of the the puzzle to the solution. So I'm encouraged to hear that other companies are making those promises and some of the bigger players in the field.
Well, I would think that maybe the kind of bioplastics that you're working on might find a use in something like, you know, what you get from Apple, for example.
Yeah, exactly. That would be the hope.
because it's not, you get the box, you open the box, it's, all these little plastic pieces are in there, but they're centered in holders, kind of, so the brittleness factor wouldn't really make any difference, I wouldn't think, or maybe make minor difference.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of applications where the properties of existing bioplastics could already replace petroleum-based plastics. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, well, if I use a biodegradable plastic, does that mean my material isn't going to be stable? Like someone brought up cars or things like that. Cars, of course, get exposed to weather, and you don't want your car melting during the lifetime that you're driving it. But a lot of the reassurance is that to have the biodegradation happen, it has to still be a pretty specific situation where you have a high enough concentration of microorganisms that are in a still environment that's warm, for quite some time. So I don't think we're at risk of, you know, these, if we went to bioplastics, of them degrading on us. But yeah, there's many applications where we could drop in, replace bioplastics right now.
Erica Majumder, our guest today, Assistant Professor of Bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Erica Majumder, an Assistant Professor of Bacteriology at the UW-Madison, talking about the research that she is doing relating, I guess you could call it landfill microbiology in a way.
Yeah, I sometimes say waste management microbiology.
So. Waste management, yeah, that's a good term for it. Stephen, Oneida County has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Erica and Larry. Great show. Learning a lot. Right now on the DNR's website, on their mining website, there's plans for a company to drill some holes in our national forest, the Shawamakon Forest. And in their plans that everybody can read, it says that they're going to attempt to bury these sulfuric acid fragments in the forest floor and then bury them or put a tarp over it and do some crazy abandonment stuff. But they say if they hit groundwater, they'll move this material and take it to a landfill. And just thinking from common sense standpoint, if you bring it's something like 75,000 pounds of acidic waste per project. If they take that to a landfill and dump that in there, wouldn't that burn a hole in the liner underneath the landfill and maybe harm this bacteria that you've been talking about? Or is there even a landfill in the state of Wisconsin that would allow high acidic rock fragments like that from a drilling project?
What do you think, Erica? We've strayed a little bit in some ways, but...
Yeah, I can attempt to partially address that question. It's a little bit out of my area, but there are hazardous waste landfills. So depending on how acidic that pH is, it may qualify for one of those, or they may need to do some pretreatment to the material before it gets deployed. But I can tell you from our work and from some of the stuff that my graduate student who leads the project, her name's Damayanti Rodriguez Ramos, she and I have been observing that there are a lot of microbes in the landfill that consume sulfate and sulfuric acid. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the natural sulfur metabolism processes that happens in any subsurface environment. It would depend on exactly what that material is and which landfill it's going to, but it would be very far away from the liner, usually, in terms of the physical nature of how a landfill is constructed.
Steve, thanks again. Bruce in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Larry, thanks for taking my call. I've been having lunch with you since the mid-1980s, on and off. Have you guys mentioned the incinerator at La Crosse, where XL Energy has been taking energy out of garbage for decades?
We haven't yet, but let's talk about it. Bruce, thanks for calling. Erica?
Yeah, thank you. We hadn't quite, no one asked about waste incineration yet, which thank you for bringing that up. That's one of the other sort of emerging waste management situations. And I've been a Wisconsinite for around 4 years now, so I'm still learning all of the processes here, but I've always been impressed with what I learn and really seen that Wisconsin has been on the cutting edge of waste management strategies for a long time. And productive uses for it towards energy, which is great. And yeah, that incinerator in La Crosse is one of the other examples. I believe, I don't know the specifications of it, so I won't try to comment, but in general, there's been globally for places where either landfilling is not an option or landfills are full or for other reasons that they've been moving towards these pyrolysis unit waste incinerators, which means they take all of the trash and they put it in and they burn it essentially, but at very high temperature and pressure. So it's not conventional burning. So you don't get the same type of toxics off gassing that you would from burning something. And they capture the heat and energy that's coming off of these pyrolysis units. And it's a different way of making renewable energy from trash. And so that's, I don't know a ton about that, but it is an emerging area that we've seen more and more municipalities going to globally as landfilling becomes less prominent.
And today, methane produced at the Dane County landfill is processed and converted, isn't it, into natural gas?
It is, yeah. We're one of the nation's leaders in that. So a few years ago, they installed a renewable natural gas plant at the Dane County landfill. And there are these wells that just look like big pipes, and they collect all the gas, and they funnel it on site to the renewable natural gas plant. It cleans up the gas and pumps the methane into an interstate pipeline for natural gas. And so, it's revenue generating for the landfill. And also, farmers have the opportunity to bring the biogas that's produced from their manure piles. And so they can pump it just like a gas station in at the renewable natural gas plant as well. So it comes, that energy comes from the landfill and from our farming community, which is fantastic.
And, you know, that gas is used for vehicle fuel. Is it kind of a model of the larger bioeconomy that you envision could be built?
Definitely. Yeah, I think. I think these types of waste-to-energy conversion projects are great because, yeah, we're using this energy instead of just venting those gases into the air, which is not good for a lot of reasons. And yeah, we like to see this type of circularity where the carbon gets used for energy, it gets used for other products instead of just being released or buried.
So. Yeah. Paula in Fitchburg, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Paula.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about black utensils. For the last 2 days, I've gotten on email notices that the black plastic cooking utensils contain a fire retardant and they should be thrown away and replaced with stainless steel or maybe silicone. And I'm wondering what you know about that.
Well, do you know anything about that, Erica?
I think you might have seen the same article that my mom texted me the other day. I don't know specifically about that. I haven't read the article yet that my mom texted me, but I believe it has something to do with the presence of PFAS or these forever chemicals, the per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. But beyond that, I can't say. But I think if the warning came from a manufacturer, things like that, then you would want to be. But yeah, I can't comment on that one specifically. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Okay. Paula, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I want to turn a little bit to some of the other research that you're doing, because you're looking at microplastics microplastics may absorb contaminants such as disease-carrying pathogens. What's the work you're doing there?
So we started doing some work with plastic contamination in the environment also. we have been working in different Wisconsin lakes, and we had some ideas that as we've started to see an increase of harmful algal blooms in many, both in the Great Lakes and inland lakes here in Wisconsin, and we also have started to see an increase in, they still call them marine debris, even when it's in a freshwater lake, but marine debris just means trash in lakes, which includes microplastics. And we know that the organisms that cause harmful algal blooms can form biofilms on substances. And so we were wondering what would happen if you have these increases of HABs and these increases of trash, if that would cause an interaction between the microbes and how that might change toxin production or toxin absorption, or if that would stimulate more bloom growth if they had these surfaces to grow on. So we've been doing a lot of experiments in the lab to try to answer those questions.
That's pretty cool. And you're also doing some work on whether the chickens sold at grocery stores have microplastics and salmonella in them.
Yeah, kind of. Not quite at the grocery store level, more on the more on like the animal production
side of things.
Yeah, more on the animal husbandry side. And so, yeah, we work with some in the collaborators in the meat science program for that. But some of the implications might be that there have been packaged meat recalls because of the presence of plastics. And so we were wondering if, similarly, like I was mentioning with the harmful algal blooms, salmonella can also form biofilms on things. So we were a little worried, or we had some research questions about if you had plastic contamination, could that further seed a pathogen like salmonella, which likes to form biofilms on surfaces? So
you're doing a lot of weird stuff. Well, you're even working in the Wyoming aquifer, for goodness sakes, to clean the uranium waste?
We work with some hydrogeologists at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and one of our field sites is an aquifer in Wyoming that has uranium contamination from a former mining site. So when he was asking about the sulfuric acid with mining, I've definitely experienced that before. The site in Wyoming we work at has a sulfuric acid plant on site. And so I'm very familiar with how that gets infiltrated into the groundwater. We have some hypotheses there about how the microbes are controlling like the mineral formations around the uranium, which has been preventing the remediation strategy from being achieved at that aquifer. And so,
who funds all your work?
Lots of different places. So we have some funding from NSF, or the National Science Foundation. We have funding from USDA on the bioplastic work, so the United States Department of Agriculture. We've had a little bit of funding from the Department of Energy on the plastic to bioplastic work, and then as well as several agencies within Wisconsin.
And I was just thinking about the UW-Madison. What are we, fifth in the U.S. in the amount of research dollars that we
are? Oh, yeah, that was just announced today. I think sixth, but we can say fifth, but I think sixth officially.
Sixth is pretty good. The five above are pretty well-known places. But you and others here at the UW are doing some really outstanding research that has very practical application. As well, there are plenty of theoretical research going on too, but your work is very practical in the end, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it spans the fundamental research to try to answer these big picture questions. That's my interpretation of the Wisconsin idea, at least.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Erica, talking with you today. I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun. I'd be happy to come back.
Erica Majumder is an assistant professor of bacteriology at the UW-Madison's Department of Bacteriology. It's great to have her with us to talk about her work. And, of course, it's always great to have you listening in, and it's great to have the team that we have here for this program. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And me, I'm Larry Mueller, and I thank you so much for listening, and I hope you stay with us because there's lots more in store here on WPR News.